We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On this episode, Self and Others. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Travis Prenzi and Mark Anthony Lewis about views of self and others in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
This is another episode in our series devoted to conversations about chapters in our Potterversity companion book of essays. On this episode, we're going to discuss inequality, inclusion, and compassion as those values are presented through the Harry Potter books. So many of the problems in our world and the wizarding world stem from perceived differences between self and others. Emily, when you were first reading the Harry Potter novels, which of the non-human characters did you struggle to relate to most as others?
Good question. I think I'm going to have to name Grop here. And I don't know, I mean, obviously it's not that super easy to relate to Grop. A lot of entertainment in uprooting trees, but I also couldn't relate to Hagrid's relation to Grop, even though he was his brother. And like, I kind of get that, but I was like, what does he see in this? Like, this is a, you know, heck of a fixer-upper project, you know? And maybe that's a totally wrong way of looking at it, but I was just like, why did he bring this creature back to the... So, and how about you, Katie?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. And I wonder if, like, I was thinking about that. That didn't occur to me to think of Grop that way, but I totally can see what you're saying. It's hard to see what Grop gives back to Hagrid, you know? What does he get? You know, what sort of mutuality exists in that relationship? And I think that shows maybe the limitations of our view of that relationship. I have say that for me, I think the goblins are a little hard to relate to, and the centaurs even. And I've always felt that the centaurs were really hard on Ferenczi. And they're kind of hard nosed.
They're sort of otherworldly, you know, like they've got a totally different scheme of knowing that they're operating under, they seem like anyway.
Right. And like, don't you know Quirrell is drinking unicorn blood right now? Like, can you help somebody out? Yeah. So they have this kind of long vision of history, you know, where they're kind of, you know, not interested in what's immediately going on. And I think that makes them a little hard to relate to. And then the goblins also, like, they're tough. They're a tough group. And it's hard to know what could be done to repair the relationship between goblins and wizards. So I think that those are kind of the ones that I struggle with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to be sort of thinking about these ideas about others and the others that we maybe struggle to relate to, and how when we are others in a, you know, in a group, how do people relate to us? And our guests today are Travis Prenzi and Mark Anthony Lewis, both of whom have explored how the wizarding world serves as a lens through which to understand the social ethics of our own world, particularly amid racial tensions and diversity. Travis Prinzi is a cardiac cartographer who also has graduate degrees in English and theology. He's been writing about Harry Potter since 2006, having edited Harry Potter for Nerds and, with me, Harry Potter for Nerds too, as well as having his own book about Harry Potter called Harry Potter and Imagination. And that is a really foundational book. I think, you know, so many things I find myself, oh, and Travis already talked about this in Harry Potter and Imagination. So it's a great go-to book. Travis's essay in the Potterversity volume is The Problem with Loving Enemies, Kindness and Oppression in The Wizard and the Hopping Pot, where he explains what this Beetle the Bard tale has to tell us about the difficulties and also the necessity of loving one's enemies. Welcome back to the show, Travis.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back.
Also joining us is Mark Anthony Lewis, who has a graduate degree in professional writing and writes on topics related to writing and rhetoric at irregardlessmagazine.com. And listeners, you should definitely check this out. There's all kinds of fun stuff on Irregardless Magazine, including a lot of really neat essays about Harry Potter that Mark Anthony has written. Mark Anthony's essay in the Potterversity book is Uncle Remus's Shack, Tokenism in the Wizarding World, and illuminates the tricky position of token magical characters in Harry Potter, from Lupin to Olymp Maxime to Ferenczi and more. Welcome back, Mark Anthony.
Thank you. Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. I'm so delighted to have the two of you on because I think there are some similar themes in these two essays that help us to think a little bit more deeply about what's happening in our own world on some really complex topics. So both of your essays are really looking at how the Harry Potter series deals with these complexities of diversity in society, particularly with regard to us and them thinking. Now, were you able to see these complexities in the Harry Potter stories right away? Or did it take rereading and rethinking for this to become clear to you?
So I think on a surface level, I saw it right away. You know, some of it, because obviously there's discussion that parallels quickly with racism, but it certainly wasn't, you know, the complexities of it in the story didn't hit me until I would say between books 6 and 7, two things were happening at that time. One is I was rereading the first 6 books in preparation for the 7th, of course. And I was also studying education at the University of Rochester, where we did entire classes on actually on critical race theory in education. You know, critical race theory being a legal framework, but there are certain tenets of it that were taken from there by people like Gloria Ladson-Billings and Shirley Bryce Heath and Beverly Tatum. I brought those concepts over into answering the question of, you know, achievement gaps and, you know, why is education not working for Black and brown kids? And some of the things in that learning started to apply to what I was rereading in Harry Potter. And I was able to see things like, you know, it isn't just personal prejudice. There's a whole system here. And it's a systemic, you know, laws that you think, for example, are just common sense laws, like, you know, the Secrecy Act, that the kids can't do magic, you know, in the summer, ends up actually being an oppressive law that keeps Muggleborns behind, because, you know, wizarding kids can practice magic all they want and not be found out about it. So it was sort of studying those two things at the same time that started, my brain started making connections, and it turned into half of the book I ended up writing.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's a common experience where you're reading Harry Potter at the same time as you're reading something else, and you start to see the connections there. Mark Anthony, what about you?
I think most of my ideas evolved out of just listening to and participating in the greater Harry Potter dialogue going on on like websites or at conferences. I think in specifically referring to like diversity and things like that, it's, I think the most obvious thing that jumps out to the reader, particularly American readers, is looking at house elves and hearing that they're slaves. And the very first thing that I think most Americans would think of is, you know, Black slavery in America. House elves are such complicated characters to figure out, to figure out why do they like it, or are they brainwashed to think they like it? And how does magic play into that? And how does their culture, but also their physiology, relate to how they work
Yeah, that's true. I always feel like I have to ruminate on these things until like something sort of falls into a pocket, you know, where I'm like, oh, okay, that framework is helping me interpret this and then this over here too, and then this over here, you know, so that's, it's kind of a magical process. Travis, The Wizard and the Hopping Pot. Okay, this is like a simple fairy tale, right, that Rowling wrote, you know, ostensibly, you know, to sort of flesh out the story world of Deathly Hallows. But it conveys a really deeper meaning about loving one's enemies. How does it do that?
Yeah, so you're right. It comes across as very simple until Dumbledore gives the historical context. And, you know, stories are what they are, and but they're not this, you know, timeless objective thing. They have different meanings. They have different emphases depending on how and when they were written. And so when you find out that this story, you know, teaching the classic moral lesson to love, you know, those who aren't like you, is situated in a time when Muggles were actively oppressing and hunting down witches and wizards, that changes everything. So it doesn't just become a story anymore about, you know, personal prejudice, you know, self versus others. It's not just about that anymore, because you could just read the story on its own and see, you know, the son's just, you know, intolerant, right? He's intolerant. He thinks people who aren't like him are less than him. And that's sort of a personal bigotry. But when you realize there's a whole power dynamic, a political power dynamic here, you know, the ongoing inequality doesn't ultimately come from, you know, you're different than me, so I don't like you. It comes from, if you reach my level, I will lose some of my power and privilege. That, you know, so it's more of a systemic thing than that. And so when you realize that dynamic is involved here, that makes it a whole lot more complex and a whole lot more difficult to love somebody who is, you know, basically stepping on your head actively. And, you know, if they knew what you are, you know, then they would burn you at the stake in that period of time. And the old man is helping them anyway. So it kind of deepens that. It makes it a lot more complex. And then I think you add to that this kind of element of almost forced empathy, that the son has to bear the burdens of the others, whether he likes it or not, through that hopping right. pot. You know, when you add that the empathy part of it too, that makes this a very interesting retelling of the moral to love your enemies.
Yeah, and we had talked a little bit about this before. The fact that the son kind of reluctantly comes around to helping people just because the pot is so annoying. You know, I mean, is that a good thing, or is that kind of, you know, the bare minimum of loving your enemies?
It's certainly a bare minimum, but you hope that over time it sinks in a little bit better. Like, oh, everything right. I was feeling from the pot, these people are feeling too. You know, you hope that it sinks in, but you never know. And the story doesn't tell us.
Well, and it's one of those stories that's really dependent on the reader's, you know, own response to it. You know, it's not finished until the reader has read it and searched their own soul, you know, about the themes involved.
Yeah. I was thinking of a NPR segment that I listened to a few years ago about a man who grew up in a really racist family. And then after going to college, he was sort of shut down in all of his ideas by his peers. And there was a discussion there about whether that works. And I think he as a person agreed that being constantly told, no, your ideas are wrong, actually did make him come around and open up his ideas about, you know, race and others and people like that, things like that. But I wonder how effective that is as a tool in a broader sense. I think there's some debate on that, whether that works or not. But
yeah, it might depend on the person as well, right? Because some person is going to dig in even harder to their beliefs.
Yeah, and the nature of the shutdown also. Like, there's a big spectrum of shutdown. You know, there's really unkind.
Sure.
You know, and then there's actually like somebody who takes the time to say, here's why you're wrong, or here's why I think differently, you know.
Yeah, there was that story about the some people who had reached out to a member of the Westboro Baptist Church Right. And they just said, let's have a conversation about what, you know, what you all are talking about. And that it did facilitate this person starting to see, oh, maybe these folks are not, maybe they're not my enemies, you know, and maybe I did have the wrong idea about it. And so there are ways that, you know, you can, hopefully we can broach some of these areas where we feel supreme difference from the others in our world. Well, Mark Anthony, you talk about tokenism and you focus a lot on the works of people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, but you also try to understand what's happening through W.E.B. Du Bois's concept of two-ness, that is not oneness, but two-ness, to help us kind of see how tokenism works. So how does that notion of two-ness manifest itself in the wizarding world? And what does it tell us about those relationships of people who, you know, who are living as minorities in this broader racialized world?
I think it's kind of fun in a Harry Potter way, because that two-ness is literal for many of the characters in Harry Potter.
Yeah, where, that's right.
Where, you know, centaurs are literally part man, part horse, and
yeah,
werewolves are part man, part wolf, and you know, Hagrid is a half giant, and mm-hmm. merpeople are half fish, half people. So it's sort of, it's fun that it's in a literal way, but it's also figuratively as well, where Du Bois talked about two-ness, where his ideas about two-ness were that, specifically he's talking about American Black people, where he says the American Negro is always feeling a two-ness, an American and a Negro, and trying to reconcile those two halves of one person. And it's sort of a, not debilitating, but it's sort of a, it's a struggle to try and reconcile those two halves of one person. Many of the part human characters in Harry Potter are sort of feeling that same thing. But we don't, you have to have read the books a few times to pick up on it, because we're mainly looking through Harry's perspective. But when you start to look at characters like Lupin or characters like Hagrid and start to try and figure out what their day-to-day life is like, you pick up that, you know, Lupin's got all of his struggles where he's hanging out with werewolves and they don't really accept him, but he's also hanging out with the wizards and they don't really accept him. And uh-huh. Hagrid goes to talk to the giants and they don't, you know, he's small, so he's not particularly valuable to them. But he's also too big for wizards and not really valuable to them either. Or look at like characters like Frenzy, you were talking about, who is banished by his centaur brethren, but ends up living alone in a little terrarium on the ground floor of Hogwarts, completely alone as well. So there's
so sad.
Right? So it's a yeah,
so they're kind of isolated.
Difficult two-ness there.
Yeah, that double nature kind of makes them at home nowhere and leads to this feeling of social isolation. That's really tough. One of the things that I thought was interesting that you had pointed out was, you know, like when Lupin is living among the werewolves, he's literally a spy. So, like, he's working for wizards. And this puts him at
he views himself that way.
Yeah. And he, you know, he's at odds with, you know, with his people in a way. And that's a very strained position to be in.
Reading Harry Potter, particularly from the perspective of Harry, it maybe doesn't sound that bad. But if you think about it, if you were to take werewolves, which are a fantasy creature, and think of them in terms of real people, whether they be, you know, Black people or, you know, people in the queer community or Jews or something like that, for someone who identifies as something to be a spy amongst their own people is kind of an icky thought, that they mm-hmm. think of themselves in that way. And that also they're being used in that way by the dominant group.
Mark Anthony, I think that's really important because, you know, this is a case where, you know, the author sort of supplies a little bit of interpretation for a character like Lupin, you know, in suggesting that maybe she was inspired by people suffering from AIDS when she, you know, was telling his story. But at the same time, you know, that's not the end of interpretation in terms of the character and what the character could mean and how we could, you know, relate him and so many others like him, these people living with this double consciousness in the story. And so I think that's really an interesting connection.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, like, for our listeners, like, Mark Anthony also gives a reading of Fenrir Greyback in this context as well, as somebody who also kind of, you know, comes to live among the Death Eater wizards. Yes. And so you'll want to check that out. Cause I, you know, hard to have some sympathy for Fenrir, but I definitely thought that Mark Anthony, your interpretation, it made real sense to me. So I'll just, you know, point our listeners to that part of the book.
So what are the solutions to the challenges of racial and social equality? Is the wizarding world headed in the right direction? And what lessons can we take from what happens in these Harry Potter stories?
I have a lot of things to say there, some of which might be right and some of which might be off base. But I think that where I was going to go was somewhere else. I'll come back to it. But I want to take it back to what Mark Anthony was doing. Because I think that the way you analyze this, Mark Anthony, when you're talking about the werewolves and the other, you know, magical communities, the dominant narrative is still the wizarding one, right? No matter what, the only way for anybody to be included is to become like the wizards. It was so simple, but you said something to the effect of, why isn't it just magical community? And then it can be all the perspectives, but no, it's only the human magical people. That's the dominant narrative. And I think until we can get to a point where it's not, oh, I'm going to include you in my dominant way of thinking, right, but I'm actually going to learn from you. I just before getting on here, I was watching, it's amazing how pervasive this mentality still is. It popped up, a UPenn law professor was telling Tucker Carlson, of all people, that Blacks and other non-Western groups harbor resentment, shame, and envy at the outsized achievements and contributions of white Western society.
Oh my.
This is a UPenn law professor. Like this notion out there that what is white and Western and European is what is normal and good and best. And we're working on just getting everybody else eventually maybe up to our standard.
And everybody else envies that, you know.
And everybody else envies what we are. And that's exactly how the wizarding world feels about all the other magical communities, is that, well, you know, we'll let them be part of our community under certain circumstances. You know, the Lupin has to go to his shack and you know, house elves can't have wands and goblins can't have wands and all that sort of thing. So it has to start with recognizing that power dynamic, I think.
It's funny you mentioned that UPenn professor, because I have a friend who tells a joke about how he says, well, I'm not racist. I treat everybody like they're white. And that's basically, that's exactly what that professor is saying.
Oops. That is on the nose.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. What about you, Mark Anthony? What do you think? What do we have to learn? And, you know, how can we apply it to our world?
Yeah, this is one of those discussions I have with all of my non Harry Potter fan friends. What's the point of this? but it's a lot easier for us to have these sort of conversations when we're talking about, you know, fantastical creatures like werewolves and centaurs, and it's fun, and it's more literal. Like I mentioned before, the two-ness of these characters is literal,
right?
So it's a lot more obvious to look at. But then when you start to treat it as if it's real, you know, I hesitate to say that, but when you start to bring your own real beliefs to the story and start to read with empathy, you can sort of bring back those ideas into your real life, and you can start to question your own prejudices or your own biases or your own trains of thought that maybe don't make as much sense now as they did before.
Yeah, and you know, I think in terms of this, when you're reading Harry Potter stories, you're not going to get defensive about the way the wizards are, right? Or the destruction of the Fountain of Magical Brethren or whatever, right? Because you don't have that instinct because you're not a magical, witcher wizard. And so it sort of breaks down a little bit the wall that we might have toward really seeing ourselves reflected. But I loved how you said reading with empathy, because, you know, there are those studies that show that reading Harry Potter has the effect of increasing empathy for people, that has been demonstrated, especially for young people. And so it can serve that really important purpose of helping you to see through the eyes of somebody who is experiencing something really different.
Yeah, I've been on a gigantic Star Trek binge for the past nearly a year. Most of our listeners know that I usually wax loquacious about Star Wars, but I've actually been watching a lot of Star Trek. But it's interesting because, I think Gene Roddenberry, the creator, wanted to make TV that addressed issues of race and issues of prejudice and issues of, societal issues that were really real to audiences. But he kept getting doors slammed in his face and people saying, you can't talk about that on TV. You can't. So he just put it all in space and, and created this narrative about, these interactions with these alien, quote unquote, alien other species and the different issues that they face, et cetera. And it was this great sort of metaphor for all these issues he really wanted to talk about. And he reached such a wider audience probably than he ever would have because, again, like Katie, what you were saying, it kind of breaks down your defensiveness or your even your self-consciousness and allows you to sort of think about it in a different way.
Yeah. And I think some of those, like the original series of Star Trek, they seem really obvious to us now, but then you look at some of the later incursions of it, and it's like it's more complicated and it's harder to see, and it's because it's more reflective of us. Creating that complex, I like what you say about the loss of your self-consciousness as you're experiencing these stories.
And there's this wonderfully subtle thing that he does. And if you go back to the original series, but you go into the movies and you get into, the fourth film where they're back to save the whales, and you think it's a piece about saving the whales.
That one.
But so all that's happening, but here's this, mission to go out and to understand other races and people, and it's all peaceful. And they have to go back to the 20th century, and he goes out to dinner with the woman and she goes, I bet they don't use money where you come from. And he says, well, we don't. And you have, money is such a big part of a power dynamic,
right?
You kind of have to realize that the dismantling of the way we do money, plays a role in how, how power structures develop. And maybe they couldn't even get to that point of thinking that way. It had to go hand in hand with, there not being haves and have nots. And I'm not talking about Soviet communism. I'm talking about, people not dying in poverty, being an important thing,
I think what the point you made there, Travis, is really interesting, because that's one of those things you can do with fiction that's much harder to do when you're having a literal discussion about literal things, is that you can, in fiction, you can create a world and you can blend ideas together and you can give a more holistic approach to topics, where you can blend things like climate change or wealth inequality or racial inequality, and you can blend all those ideas together in ways that's more difficult to do when you're talking about something literally.
Yeah, and I sort of feel like what both of you are showing with your essays is the power of story, the power of narrative, in a way that readers can understand it and don't even necessarily always even know it's showing you things that are really complicated and things that are challenging even fundamental beliefs. But that's the power of narrative and the power of story that I think we can see, through the Harry Potter series. And so just to kind of take this to a somewhat esoteric level, your section of the book is called Self and Other. And we've been talking a lot about that through our conversation. So what difficulties do you two see in our thinking about ourselves in relation to others and the way we see others in relation to ourselves? So just thinking about that us versus them dynamic, you know, what are the difficulties there that narrative can overcome?
One of the big things, obviously, about, you know, the other is fear of the unknown. That's a big part of the Harry Potter series are much about fear of the unknown, and that, you know, there's the fear of death. What lies beyond that? That's a big theme. But, you know, somebody who's different than me is also unknown. And so fear, I tend to think of fear as the real opposite of love rather than hate. And overcoming, my essay is kind of located in, you know, kind of religious and moral teaching. You know, there's the kind of basic love commands that are given in the New Testament, for example, are love God, love your neighbor as yourself, you know, and then love your enemy. There's that challenge that the one person comes up and gives Jesus and says, well, who is my neighbor? You know, and instead of defining the neighbor, you know, Jesus gives a story kind of dismantling the man's prejudice and showing that, you know, that even those horrible Samaritan people can be loving neighbors. And so there's a overcoming of one's fear so that you can open your eyes up to see people differently and equally, that I think is vital to this whole conversation.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Seeing fear at the root of the otherness and the idea of them being separate from me.
I think I agree with Travis, but I think there's another dimension that makes it a little more difficult in that even if we want to accept others into the umbrella of us, even then we have to acknowledge that other people are different and are okay with their differences and want to be different also. Mm-hmm. And to try and that reconciling those two ideas is really difficult. And I don't even know what the solution is to that, but it's, you know, it's like, all people, all earth life is related, right? We're all from the same primordial soup, but we're all different too. And you can't treat a dog like a person and think that you're treating the dog well, because dogs have different needs than people do. And like we talked about earlier, you can't treat all people as if they're white and think that that's doing them a favor. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of remember that some of those differences are real, and they're not necessarily a bad thing. Being able to reconcile those two ideas that we're all related but we're all different is one of those difficult things that doesn't necessarily come from hate or fear, but just from the difficultness of being a person. Right?
I think one of the things that just struck me, that, you know, we are supposed to identify with Harry throughout the series. You know how many times Harry was wrong about his assumptions? About just about anything. And so I think the imaginative experience of being wrong, mm-hmm. You know, it might train me, for example, to be willing to be wrong about things that I've always assumed were the norm and were right. And, you know, the right way to do things. Like I'm a lifelong grammar police, realizing that, you know, that's not something that's the white Western way of speaking, and that's correct, right? Well, not necessarily. Just right. As a little example, like it's important to be able to be wrong and to say this, even this thing I've kind of held on to my whole life as being the way the world is. Well, that person over there who's equally as human as me and probably smarter sees it completely differently. So taking the time to sit down and question your assumptions and hear from somebody else and rethink it is so important.
The freedom to be wrong too, I think, is important. Not just acknowledging that you can be wrong, but also the freedom to be able to express your wrongness and talk it out and figure it out is important too, because it's not helpful to just keep it locked up in your head either, because you'll never be right.
And we live in such a gotcha world where as soon as you say you're wrong, somebody's ready to discredit you and say, see, you're stupid. I'm the smart one. And there's a fear of that. So Right. the freedom to be wrong is, and that being a safe thing to do is important.
Yeah. It's a privilege to be wrong and to be able to kind of publicly learn, you know, and learn a different way. And
yeah. And I'm, you know, as I'm thinking about this, I'm also thinking, Mark Anthony, your essay on tokenism, I mean, it's a real challenge to, I think, people who want a world that is more inclusive and they don't know how to do it except for tokenism. And, you know, what you are pointing out throughout the essay are just the tremendous limitations of that. And how can we be inclusive without having, you know, sort of bringing people in as tokens and creating this two-ness problem? And I think it does have to do with what you both have been talking about in terms of getting rid of the idea that there is one standard that is normal, that is, you know, the way everything should be, and everything needs to sort of, you know, be blended. I mean, I think of the American melting pot, right? Which that was the metaphor when I was growing up in school, was the melting pot, right? That we're all supposed to be melted together in what ends up being a kind of wasp soup, I guess.
Yum. You know,
a TV dinner.
Assimilation under high high temperatures. Yes, right. TV dinner. But the metaphor that I guess kids use now is the salad bowl. I don't know if you know this, where the idea is that, you know, that everybody's not supposed to end up the same, that there has to be room for all of the differences to play their part and to, you know, to all be equally valued. So I think, as you say, Mark Anthony, the challenges of actually achieving that are enormous. And Travis, your point about the structural aspects that we're often even unconscious of, you know, it just creates these huge challenges. But what an important thing to do, to be able to think and talk about those through the characters that we find in, you know, in just a fantasy novel like Harry Potter.
I want to talk about Star Trek more.
I'm open to that. I just did the Next Generation last summer, so I'm philosophically, Roddenberry wanted Star Trek to exist in like a utopian world where everybody, people don't solve their problems through like fighting, but that they sort of solve problems together. And that was sort of the conceit of like the original Star Trek, and then sort of Next Generation also. But is Deep Space Nine the one where they sort of deconstruct that and sort of dismantle it?
I think a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It's this outpost where literally they are all trying to, if you've got all these different groups of people living together, and the Bajorans and the Cardassians are kind of like Jews and Nazis trying to inhabit this same part of space with all these other people as well. And it's a really interesting and complex challenge, and it has a lot of religion and politics in it, which makes it, I think, really interesting. Star Trek's.
But I think they started it maybe when Roddenberry was still around, but then he died, and then that really took it in a different direction.
So
I've heard.
Well, thanks so much, Travis and Mark Anthony, for joining us on the show today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, we've only touched the surface of these really fascinating essays. So to read their full chapters, definitely pick up a copy of our Potterversity book and then let us know what you think. Today, we're going to end with a quote from Albus Dumbledore when he was talking to Harry about the reasons for creatures' betrayal in the Order of the Phoenix. And Dumbledore said, "Indifference and neglect often do much more damage than outright dislike." Wishing for more compassion and attention for all those who struggle in our world.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Tau, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.